IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome to episode 73 of the Killing It,
Killing It Podcast.
Next time, Ryan won't be drinking coffee while I start.
Live recording, even though it's a recording.
That's not a pre-done sound effect.
Everybody. Exactly.
We literally do that.
We don't redo this again and again and again.
See,
welcome we're having to fun. We hope yet another else. Socially distanced podcast. So we have a sponsor message.
We do. We really appreciate the sponsors. And this week we are supported by PCmatic, endpoint security built on a zero trust philosophy, allowing only trusted applications and blocking all the rest. Lightweight, simple to deploy, easy to manage. Find out about PCmatic's unique lead sharing program for MSPs backed by a primetime national TV campaign. Together, they bring advanced security solutions combined with more than sales enablement. They bring actual leads. Find out more about PCmatic by visiting PCmatic.com/MSP.
And of course, we always encourage you to not only support the people who support us, but also you can support us by simply sharing, giving a thumbs up, click the 4 stars or the 5 stars and, you know, spreading the word, which, by the way, our audience is growing like crazy. So that's all cool.
That has been super cool to watch the audience grow. I guess everyone trapped at home is looking for new, interesting ways to listen to stuff. And thank you for listening to us have some fun.
When you finally make it to the other end of Netflix and you turn around and go, great, now what? Hey, we're right over here. We've got many very detailed opinions to share with you.
Yes, when you're done, when you watched every single thing on Netflix, then turn to us. So,
well, Ryan, you found something that's going to kick us off, right?
I did, and I will say there is magic in data, right? Like nobody that listens to this program is surprised by the fact that we are data hounds. We love to see research and understand what's happening in the marketplace. And while all of us have been experiencing the disruption of the pandemic, working from home, servicing clients remotely, changing the way that we are doing business and acquiring customers, all of our individual experiences have been very isolating, right? I think that that's been one of the most compelling impacts of this whole disruption, is how we have been a community, we have known each other, and we have been in the same places so many times over the years, and now we all went back into our own little bubbles, which can lead to a lot of misperception about the way that things are working and what will be successful. We found some data here that is, I believe, on the fascinating level, because it's speaking directly to what our friends over at McKinsey did a survey on the topic of what they call a commercial recovery post COVID-19. Commercial meaning, how do you go and get customers? Not just do you have salespeople, but what techniques do you use? What channels do you utilize? And how are you actually going to market? There were two things that jumped out at this, and I'd love to hear your feedback on this as well. One of them, they looked at what are, from the customer's point of view, the most effective and valued interactions that they have with sellers. Where do they get the information, and what is it shaped like? What channels does it come from? They compare digital channels and traditional channels, right? Traditional telephone and referral and a trade show and a call from a salesperson. Digital meaning online and paid advertising per click and web search and social selling. They rank these things out from the customer's point of view, which ones are most effective. Of the top five, the only one that was a traditional method in the top five was a face-to-face visit from a sales human. Everything else is a digital channel. Now, 2 years ago, 5 years ago, that would have been radically different. It would have been nice to have some cute little social selling things. But now your customer is telling us, in a B2B world, I fundamentally prefer these digital channels, and we need to be adapting to it. The second piece that absolutely made me go, wait a second, this is a whole new world. They asked decision makers in B2B companies who are selling in this disrupted environment, have you had to make a significant change to your strategy and your go-to-market process? 92% of the respondents said yes. Of those people who said yes, 65% of them indicated that their new adjusted plan is as effective or more effective than what they were doing before. Let me put a fine point on that. If you got disrupted, you had to go home, you had to band-aid and duct tape some things together to work from home, you can't go visit customers, you feel like that's a radical disruption. And many of us have heard others say, I just can't wait till we can finally get back to the way that we used to do business. Except 2 out of 3 of your peers indicate, in terms of lead generation, quantity of opportunities, dollar of pipeline, they're actually being more effective remotely on these collaboration platforms than they were before. In other words, if you are still sitting back going, holy cow, I can't wait till this isn't working, you are in the radical minority here. And that's the sound of the market leaving you behind. It's a survival imperative now.
It's funny how disruption causes everyone to break habits. Like it's the, right. You know, I did this one thing and I knew what it would always let me do and I knew what it would get me. And so I just kept doing it because it was very reliable. And now that thing is gone and lots of people are going, huh, there's like better ways of doing this. Well, and it's amazing.
Yeah, there is no better way to possibly do this until it's the only way.
Right.
And funny enough, it becomes better.
We are all three fans of Daniel Burris, right? Who's just super clear. Like everything that needs to happen in technology in the next 5 years already exists. So it's just a matter of, you know, how much of it is sitting there waiting for its opportunity. And, you know, this is a perfect example. I love the quote sort of early on in here that our research suggests that companies are more likely to thrive if they act aggressively to capture market share during downturns rather than wait until the recovery begins. In other words, you know, don't sit around and saying, oh, I can't wait for this to be over before I start making sales again. Like, your competition's already making sales.
And doing things differently. I mean, and doing things differently. Like, I think it is okay to re-examine all of those assumptions. Because, by the way, everybody that's doing that is seeing that there's lots of new ways to do it. Like, you've got 3 guys who love getting on stage and talking to people. But you know what we're also having fun doing? Talking to people in your earbuds.
Like, I know those 3 guys.
Right. And you're finding these ways. The one thing I always want to sort of put in there, particularly because Ryan, you use the phrase social selling. And what I want to emphasize to people is look, you're kind of getting tired of the too many webinar thing because it's not authentic and it's not interesting and engaging. That's don't think that you're seeing all of this flood of kind of webinars and like, you know, flood of all these. This is people experimenting. The people that are winning are the ones that are finding out new and interesting ways to deliver this stuff. You know, I didn't have to necessarily do an hour-long presentation. I can do a 7-minute video and deliver way more value in a much more tight package. Like, it's get creative. Don't think you have to forklift previous things.
Well, in virtual. I won't mention any vendors, but I've had vendors tell me, please don't mention COVID. Don't mention the pandemic. Don't mention the recession because we want this to be an evergreen webinar. And all I could think of is, no, you don't. What you want is for people to get value today.
Right.
And say, this is what you should be doing because this webinar is, no one is going to watch it in 2021. Sorry, you know, even though I'm the star, no one is going to watch this, right? So give advice that can be useful today. In this environment. And guess what? Some of that may stick around and still be useful next year.
Yeah, and see, this is the thing, right? If you have all the best strategies for evergreen content that will last all into the future, including when we are no longer in a recession, but you do not do something valuable during the recession, logic dictates you might not be around post-recession to do all of that evergreen stuff. Let's focus first on surviving, then on adapting and thriving beyond. This is, and again, we wanted to put this story in here first, and I'm very passionate about this one because it does speak to the world of technology solutions in a B2B environment. No matter how good your technology is, no matter how valuable your solution might be, if you do not go out and sell it aggressively, proactively, it doesn't matter how good the solution is.
And we're almost out of time on this, but I did want Dave to pipe in about the second link on the CIOs, because you were kind of hot on, you know, there are people who have already figured out which direction they want to go.
Well, yeah. I mean, so Gartner has some new data talking about the fact that 43% of companies have already begun their post-COVID-19 strategy. So those CIOs are already digging in on, okay, this is what we're going to be doing on the other side of this. So that's not just the, hey, I'm pivoting now. These are the ones that are saying, okay, when what's on the other side happens, because I don't want to call it going, because it will, and it's not going to look like what we came from, and it's not going to look like now, it's going to be something else. They are already thinking about that. That's 43%. Now, by the way, the inverse of that means there's some, you know, 67% out there that you can engage with and help them think about what's going to happen on the other side. But we're coming up on 50%, everybody, of already that are digging in thinking about the other side.
Yeah, they are thinking this way and they are making plans. And if they are making plans without you in the conversation, that's a really bad business development strategy.
So it's funny because the other thing I laugh at is I've clearly thrown out all the rules on evergreen content. I make podcasts daily of today's news.
Right, exactly. this is good for 20 minutes.
Exactly. This one, I mean, look, I always laugh. I don't expect anybody to go back and listen to one from 3 months ago. But sometimes they do. Speaking of that though, I want to talk about something that clearly I am the guy beating the drum on regulation. And there was an interesting article in the New York Times, with the headline of Facebook must better police online hate, state attorneys general say, and call from 20 state officials adding to the rising pressure facing Zuckerberg and his company. Now, we could do a whole riff on the social media companies and all of that, but that's not where I want to go with this, actually. What I wanted to bounce off you guys was your thinking of, look, from a regulator's perspective, like it's making sense to me that AGs are getting involved in some of this stuff, both at the big tech level, but we also see it, you know, probably is where it's going to be coming from the next round of legislation, particularly for smaller providers. What's your take on AGs getting involved, secretaries of states getting involved? You know, why is the government moving and what's their motivation and why are you paying attention to it?
Well, first of all, let me just say, I do not envy anybody on Facebook or Twitter or any of these social media trying to keep sanity on their own site. The fact that in that article, Facebook says, we are spending billions of dollars trying to reduce harassment online and so forth. It's like, it is an overwhelming job. So first there's that. But in terms of regulation, it's really hard to regulate something like this because what constitutes harassment, right? I mean, it's in many ways, it reminds me of the old discussion about porn. I can't define it, but I know it when I see it, right? So how do you define what constitutes harassment? Because everybody wants to talk about the Second Amendment. The First Amendment is free speech, right? Right. So it's only offensive speech that needs to be protected. So how do you draw those lines? Because saying you're ugly is one thing, but saying I'm going to beat you up because you're ugly, or I want other people to go beat you up because you're ugly, is a completely different thing. So where do you draw the line? And how do you do that with online, where organizations can come into existence, spew out millions of hate speech posts, and then simply disappear? Like, yikes.
See, and to that point, this is why I'm always very reluctant to propose new regulations via legislation, because those of us who have lived through HIPAA and the Sarbanes-Oxley and all of these things, we all know, we've always joked that, you know, hey, a technology seller's best friend is a new government regulation that nobody understands and they need to spend money to comply with. It's complicated. It's bureaucratic. It's going to move slowly. However, in this case, it is absolutely necessary because none of our current schemes or rules have ever anticipated the pace, the volume, and the diversity of sources that we're dealing with in terms of this content moderation. When we wrote the Constitution, we did not anticipate billions of simultaneous users doing hundreds of billions of daily messages on multiple platforms. That quantity just cannot be fathomed, and nothing, even from 1996, thank you very much, nothing from our regulatory scheme can cope with that kind of volume and pace. We need new mechanisms to be able to do that. And frankly, if the AGs are going to get involved with it here and you think, okay, well, now that's going to be interesting. Well, we've talked before about how the US is going to have more than one way of approaching it. And Europe's going to have a different way, and Canada's going to have a different way, and Asia. And by the way, Eastern Europe versus Western Europe. And, you know, I think, Dave, months ago, you came up with the good breakdown on this. Is it democratic or is it autocratic, right? Are we looking at areas where we want free speech, or are we looking at countries where they just fundamentally want to control speech? And those are going to be two completely different regimes. I think that our systems cannot presently handle this. And so somebody at the local level needs to figure out a way to kind of just ensure that these platforms can be used positively, which, by the way, I am a guy saying that social media can be a positive influence if you can find a way to control and to regulate that kind of definition of hate speech. It's not a small thing. I think this is a social level.
Here's where I'm gonna be a little contrarian, and I'm gonna actually sort of like say that, look, remember, this isn't a free speech debate. These are private companies in private spaces doing private company things, right? This is not, there's the big companies want you to think it's a constitutional issue. They want you to think it's a free speech one. It is not. The First Amendment is about government getting involved. The reason that I think this is interesting is this is telling that state legislatures have identified that there is a problem. They do not have a solution. And in lieu of industry offering them a solution, they are having to step in and muddle through. So my argument on this is always is the, I look at these and say, look, if the AGs are getting involved, I think it's, I'm looking at the big tech here, but I'm also looking at what they're doing on smaller companies. When I think about cyber crimes and what's happening from that perspective, the same statement is true. They have identified that there is a problem. They do not know how to solve it, but industry is not offering them a solution.
Yeah, so, but see, to your point, just real quick there, to your point, as soon as the AG and the legislature gets involved, that's how a non-First Amendment issue becomes a First Amendment issue.
Well, okay, exactly. So where the so I want to make this conversation, I want to frame this into my continual push here around solution providers is, I want you to think about what's happening to these big companies. And then I want you to think about what's happening to you on the security front. And this is why these same government agencies are going to be looking at the technology service provider space. And I want you to draw those parallels. We're not going to be able to debate the particular solution, but I want you to see the same reasons that they are moving on the big companies are the reasons they are going to move on the smaller companies when it comes to security.
Well, and it's also the case, the big companies like, you know, Facebook has billions to spend. I don't, right? So I'm going to succumb to very little pressure where Facebook can stand up and say, you know, all right, let's take another stab at this. Let's keep working on it. You know, one of the links in this article is to a 96-page report from Facebook on their civil rights activity and what they've done. And I haven't read through it, but part of, you know, part of the point is neither has any legislator, right? This is one of the things that big companies can do is they can get 700 lawyers to write enough documents that they overwhelm the legislature. And then it just creates more FUD. And who knows what good legislation can come out of that.
Well, so this is why I'm going to say, like, this is why solution providers have to band together. This is what your associations are for. This is what your peer groups are for. This is what your whatever membership organization, like, these groups need to be get called on to consolidate that into a conversation around what solution providers want. You can, and again, MSP, solution providers, tech service, whatever you want to call them, don't wait for it to happen to you or the vendors to solve this for you, because you're going to have to do something about it.
Yeah, and we'll put a link to the Facebook group that Dave and I help Amy Babinchak admin on legislation and regulation.
Yep.
Yeah. I think that's where it's going to come from. I do not believe, and I'll say it again, I do not believe that Facebook wants to self-regulate. I do not believe that they are capable of self-regulating, and they are not the only ones. I don't think the solution is going to come from inside those platform vendors, and the legislation is going to be cumbersome, and it's going to be a burden for people to deal with. It needs to come as local as possible. You, as a solution provider, are going to be dealing with customers who feel the implications of these regulatory changes. You need to be proactive and solve this problem locally for your customers. I think that's where the real value is.
Yep.
All righty. So that's it's now time for topic number three, which has always been our, you know, for recently anyway, life after COVID. what do we think the world might look like? And so the topic this week is, what kind of changes are in place for workers? And it's interesting because some workers have actually done really, really well in this. Others have been laid off, right? Some of them, it's that, you know, you can argue it's not their fault. But one of the debates going on, at least in California, is are these independent workers, for example, Uber drivers, are they independent employees? Are they contractors? Or should they be W-2 employees? And, you know, the drivers are not unified on this. You know, this is one of these things where the legislation in California was put in place on behalf of the drivers, kind of without their permission. And so there's a lot of drivers who are saying, well, I don't want to be a full-time employee because, you know, they want to work 7 hours here, 14 hours there, 12 hours there. They work for six different organizations and they're okay making what they make. At the same time, and Uber's not the only one, there are large companies, and Amazon comes to mind, that are actually advertising that, hey, you can start your business organizing Amazon deliveries in your neighborhood. And when you do the math, it comes out to be like $4 an hour. But if people choose to do that, should we say, no, you're not allowed to make that choice?
Well, see, the interesting thing about it is we're trying to couch this into an or. Like, you are either like a W-2 employed or you are a 1099 contractor. And I think that this is the problem. And the reason why I'm going to make it relate immediately to a small provider is, look, you employ people. You have a voice in this. You should think about the changes you want in the spectrum and make sure your own representatives are aware of that, or your association or whatever that is. Because I think the problem is we're trying this or. There's a middle ground where you might be something in between, right? Like let's talk about an Uber driver, right? Are they a W-2 employee? Probably not. Are they a fully independent contractor? Nah.
No.
Some of those are, I mean, like, they aren't. There is some dependency on the company in terms of their revenue, in terms of the way they engage. There are a bunch of drivers out there. There are some that work 40 hours a week. That is their full time. There's others that drive 8 hours a week and it's pickup work. by making it this binary choice, we're actually making it way harder to innovate, to be creative, to come up with new solutions. We've got to be able to find a way as a society and for the benefit of the market to make it so that employees can play in the gray.
Absolutely. And again, this is your life and your business right now. I know many solution providers around the country who run a business that from the website and from the customer's experience appears to be a large, structured, traditional organization. We've got office workers, accounting workers, we've got salespeople, technical people, we've got executives, we can come to your location, you can meet us at ours. Yeah, except that business is entirely virtual. Everybody is remote. We only go to a facility when we need a formal meeting space, and we have contractors that come in and out as needed on a specialized solution basis, and they are not fixed cost in our business model. Now, that's an incredibly popular business model. We look big and structured. We are informal and small. It gives us the appearance to compete against bigger players, and yet it radically reduces our fixed cost of business operation. Okay, the government, and we're not, like, let's not underread this for a second. This is not just are they or aren't they. A judge in a court said, yes, they are. And now we know that's going to be appealed and it's going to go on forever. But do not underestimate the reach of this kind of a decision. If that affects Uber, it's going to affect Airbnb. If it affects them, it's going to affect a part-time worker in a delivery business. And that will absolutely affect your 1099s who are working with you in your organization. Well,
and I have to agree with Dave that I think that the direction we're going has to be this hybrid acknowledgement that I can be a DoorDash deliverer in the morning and a, you know, W-2 employee in the afternoon for two different organizations, or maybe even for same industry. But the reason that the government cares is, okay, who's covering your healthcare? Who's covering your workers' comp? Who's covering your, you know, unemployment insurance? Like, are you eligible for unemployment if you work on the edge, you know, agree to work for... minimum wage.
Look, we're flirting with politics here, but remember that if you can figure out ways to get creative with these solutions, it potentially opens up a lot of possibilities for new business models, for new ways of employing people. If those questions get solved, if it's easier to deliver healthcare, if I'm thinking of myself as like a small solution provider, I'd love to be able to make sure that I could engage and have people engage with me, not necessarily always all full-time employees, maybe some parts, but be able to have it where maybe I don't have to worry about all the benefits in order to deliver those and deliver other value to the market, yet have those people want to work with me and still have their needs met as well. Like I think everyone likes to frame this from the perspective of like, oh my God, it's this horrible problem. It's like, no, we're actually trying to open up some different ways of engaging if we can solve this problem.
Well, and the original motivation of this was, you know, the Uber environment is the human representation of the sharing economy. It's where Airbnb came from, right? I have a fixed asset that I do not use all of the time. I don't want to sell that asset. I would just like to occasionally lease it out to somebody who could use it fractionally for a little bit of time. Well, when you apply that concept to human resources, if I've got spare capacity and I want to spend a little of my free time doing something additional, and you don't have to go through all of those legal loopholes to bring me on, that's good for both sides. Where it went wrong and where it's become a problem is that what has been an emerging entrepreneurial concept has been kind of figured out and manipulated by large businesses against the interests of their workers, right?
Well,
if anybody was just operating in a friendly way, we wouldn't need the government to get involved.
Uber is actually a perfect example, because part of what's going on in California is, you know, they have been legally required to be an employer since January 1st of this year. And they have basically said, we are going to do what we always do. We're going to ignore that law until we don't have any choice. And so they happen to actually employ, you know, their workers when legally they are required to do so. And so, you know, there's also this piece of who are the goodwill actors and who are not. Because if you want to rent me your cabin, you know, by the lake for the weekend, that's just the two of us and it's all good, right? But when you do that times 10,000 people and 10,000 strangers, now the insurance companies want to be involved. There's lots of stuff you have to consider. And so what seems like a simple thing turns into a much more complex relationship when you do it on a massive scale. And at some point, it should have some regulations.
Yeah, but God bless the entrepreneurs who try, right? Who are figuring this stuff out. Because I remember we were in Europe someplace going into some tourist thing. And, you know, in a place, this was years ago, a place that I did not expect to have Uber. And Uber was right there. And it was the easiest, cleanest thing. I opened up my app. I'm on the other side of the world. And I showed up someplace. And I remember standing in line waiting to go in and thinking, that is remarkable. Like somebody on the other side of the world had an idea and they didn't figure out employment law and safety and taxes and all that stuff. They just went out and did it. And then when something went wrong, they fixed it and they continued to improve. If you had to try and figure out fractional employment and all of its dimensions before you did the first one, it would never happen.
Yeah, but Ryan, I cannot let this be the last point, because let me observe, Uber ain't making any money. that is a bit, while a brilliant idea, that is a company that is subsidizing those rides. So yeah, you think, oh, this is a great thing. It's opened up new economy. Nah, not so much, sir. That's not actually
profitable. They're not, DoorDash is not, Airbnb is not.
So just because the service is available doesn't mean that I'm paying enough for it to make money.
Enough for it, right.
Sadly, we are out of time. But we will definitely revisit this. I will note that there's now a service where you can just put up your swimming pool by the hour for total randos to come and swim in your swimming pool.
There's so, one for closets too. You can give away your closet space.
Very good. Well, fun as always. Thank you for tuning in. This has been episode 73 of the Killing It.
Killing It.
Oh, you suck. Podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.